You are listening to a podcast from Raritan Valley Community College.
I think incorporated the message and brought to light the words of many of our great orators and leaders of the time. I'm going to invite their director, Wanda Telefaro, to come forward to be able to introduce the New Jersey orators. Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here, and we so appreciate the invitation. Good evening. My name is Wanda Taliaferro. I'm one of the board members for an organization called the New Jersey Orators. And we teach young people between the ages of 7 and 18 the art of public speaking. We're an organization that was founded in 1985 by a small group of African-American executives who wanted to improve the public speaking skills of our children. And actually, one of the founding members of the New Jersey Orators was working for a major corporation at the time, back in 1985, and was responsible for delivering a presentation, and he almost fainted. And he never wanted a young person to be able to go through that, so the New Jersey Orators organization was born. It's an organization that I'm very passionate about. I've been involved with the organization for 10 years. 4 years as an executive board member and 6 years as a coach for the Plainfield chapter. We've grown from one chapter in Somerset, New Jersey in 1985 to over 17 chapters in 2012, and we're very proud of that. As you will see, if you were to visit our website or come to any of our events, most of our organization, most of our orators are young African-American students. But we are an organization of great orators who just happen to be African-American. And so what we're trying to do is educate our communities, educate our churches and other organizations that Black History Month, which is the month of February, should not be the only month where our orators are shuttled back and forth between a tremendous number of events, but they have the ability to speak on any topic. And so we are seeing more organizations inviting us during the month of March, for example, for Women's History Month, or April for Poetry Month, or throughout the year. So we're very happy to accept this invitation today. If you come to some of our chapter meetings or happen to have the privilege to come to some of our year-end competitions, you will see that our young people pick selections where they have to completely memorize selections that are 5 minutes or more. And so for those of us who think that our children are lost and that they don't have much to do with their time or they only memorize songs, you will see something very different and have a very different experience if you're associated with our organization. As our children get older, so as they start to reach high school, you'll see that they also begin to write their own oratory. They write their own original pieces, and so you begin to see that they write things that really speak to them. So sometimes the 7 and 8 year olds, when they are introducing their selections, they say, well, my mother picked this for me, my father picked this for me. But as they get to be in high school, they really pick topics that speak to them. They pick topics about the war, they pick topics about 9/11, people who have lost family members of 9/11, and our kids are spectacular, we're proud of that. We've developed relationships with companies and organizations over these 27 years, and we get frequent invitations from corporations like Bristol Myers, for example, AT&T, Johnson & Johnson, but we're certainly glad to be able to begin to develop a relationship with the Raritan Valley Community College. These types of events provide opportunities for our children outside of a competition setting, and many of our children have been able to present in front of people like Cornel West, Dr. Henry Louis Gates, and some of our orators were even invited to the New Jersey PAC to present before Bishop Desmond Tutu. So again, that's something that we're also very proud of. We are a volunteer-run organization of over 300 volunteers from the community. People who volunteer to be coaches in one of our 17 chapters, volunteer to be a competition judge at the end of the year cycle in May and December for our competitions. And so there are a tremendous amount of people in the community who are willing to volunteer and give up of their time. So if you are interested in being a volunteer, please see me after the program. I'd be more than happy to connect you with a chapter that is close to either where you live or where you work. I'd now like to introduce you to our first orator, ladies before gentlemen. So I'd like to introduce you to Zamara Amegwa, who is one of our seasoned orators. She's been with the orators for a very long time. And actually, I met Zamara when I was a coach for the Plainfield chapter many years ago. She's 17 years old, and she's a senior at the Union County Academy for Allied Health Sciences in Scotch Plains, New Jersey. She's a member of HOSHA, Health Occupation Students of America, and sits on the Peer-to-Peer Mediation Committee at her school. She's a member of the Plainfield chapter of the New Jersey Orators and has earned several excellence awards during the competitions for public speaking and has appeared in a number of public speaking and corporate events. She's a middle distance runner and currently serves as captain of both the indoor and outdoor Plainfield track teams. She's a member of the Horizon Richmond program aimed at mentoring high school students. And she's also a Sunday school teacher where she attends church, which is the Wellesley United Methodist Church of Edison. Zamara is preparing to go to college and is very excited about that. She currently has three offers, so she has a choice of where she'd like to go. So she has been accepted to Hampton University, Susquehanna University of Florida, and Rowan University. And she's expecting decisions from four other schools as well. And she'll be making her final choice around mid-April. So please join me in welcoming Zamara Amegwa, and she will give you a spectacular rendition of Hayden's High Moon.
Born Isabella Bumfrey on April 9, 1797, she was sold away from her family at age 9 and was abused and brutally beaten by her masters. Sojourner Truth knew firsthand the cruelty of slavery. And when this exceptional woman was freed, she dedicated her life to helping those of color and women. Good day. My name is Zamara Amegwa, and I am a proud member of the Plainfield chapter of the New Jersey Orators. Today, I will be presenting to you Sojourner Truth's famous Ain't I a Woman speech, which she gave at a women's convention in Akron, Ohio in 1851. And now I present to you Ain't I a Woman. Well, children, where there's so much racket, there must be something out of kilter. You know, I think this twits the Negroes of the South and the women of the North, all talking about rights. White man gonna be in a fix pretty soon. But what's all this here talking about? That man over there says that women need to be helped into carriages and lifted over mud puddles and have the best place everywhere. Nobody ever helps me into carriages or over mud puddles or gives me the best place everywhere. And ain't I a woman? Look at me. Look at my arms. I have plowed and planted and gathered into the barns and no man could head me. And ain't I a woman? I could work as much and eat as much as any man when I can get it. And bear the lash as well. And ain't I a woman? I have borne 13 children. And see most all of them sold off to slavery. And when I cry out, when my mother's grief, no one but Jesus heard me. And ain't I a woman? Then they go on and talk about this thing in the head. What's it they call it? Intellect. That's it. What does that have to do with women's rights or Negroes' rights? For example, if my cup won't hold but a pint, and yours holds a quart, wouldn't you be mean not to let me have my little half measure full? And then, this little man in the black over here, he said, oh, women can't have as much rights as men because Christ, he wasn't a woman. Where did your Christ come from? No, really, where did your Christ come from? God and a woman. Man had nothing to do with him. If the first woman that God ever made was strong enough to take the world and turn it upside down, then all these women here together ought to be able to take it and turn it right side up again. And God would ask you to do it. The men better let them. Obliged to you for hearing me. But now, also Jordan Truth ain't got nothing more to say. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Samara. Now I'd like to introduce you to Austin Brooks. Austin Brooks is a highly motivated seventh grader at the Linwood Middle School in North Brunswick, New Jersey. He is a dedicated member of the travel, basketball, and baseball team. As a previous member of the student council, he displayed leadership skills and became a role model for the student body. That's quite an achievement for a young man. He has a love for music and particularly enjoys playing his alto saxophone and listening to jazz. So I wasn't listening to jazz when I was in the second grade. Through his joy in reading, Austin has found mystery books quite enjoyable. Among his other interests, he enjoys being a member of the Junior Usher Board and visiting the elderly. Austin has aspirations of becoming a marine biologist and protecting marine life. He is proud to be a member of the Somerset chapter of the New Jersey Orators, and he thoroughly enjoys being a member of an organization like the New Jersey Orators that challenges, inspires, and supports its participants to develop their communication skills. Please join me in welcoming Austin Brooks, and he will deliver us a selection of the Freedom Fighters.
Sit-ins, freedom rides, and demonstrations. The civil rights movement was a struggle for African Americans from the mid-1950s to the late 1960s to achieve civil rights equal to those of whites in housing, employment, and education. Hello, my name is Austin Brooks, and I am a proud and dedicated member of the Somerset chapter of the New Jersey Orators. Today, I will be presented in the category of original oratory. My piece is called Sit-ins, Freedom Rides, and Demonstrations. In 1960, four freshmen from North Carolina A&T strolled into the F.W. Woolworth store and quietly sat down at the lunch counter. They were not served, but they stayed until closing time. The next morning, they came back with 25 more students. 2 weeks later, similar demonstrations had spread to several cities. Within a year, peaceful demonstrations took place in over 100 cities, north and south. As the sit-ins continued, tension grew in Greensboro, and students began a far-reaching boycott of stores that had segregated lunch counters. Sales at the boycott stores dropped by a third, leading the store's owners to abandon their segregation policies. Black employees of Greensboro and Woolworth stores were the first to be served at the store's lunch counters on July 25th, 1960. The next day, the entire Woolworth chain was desegregated, serving blacks and whites alike. Freedom Riders. The Freedom Riders of the early 1960s, organized by the Congress of Racial Equality, also known as CORE, rolled through the South, seeking integration of the bus, railroad, and airport terminals. The first freedom ride took place on May 4th, 1961, when seven blacks and six whites left Washington, D.C. on two public buses bound for the Deep South. They intended to test the Supreme Court ruling in Boynton v. Virginia in 1960, which declared segregation in interstate bus and rail stations unconstitutional. In the first few days, the riders encountered only minor hostility. But in the second week, whites attacked the riders only two blocks from the sheriff's department. With the intervention of the U.S. Justice Department, most of CORE's freedom riders were evacuated from Birmingham, Alabama, to New Orleans. CORE leaders decided that letting violence in the troop was sending the wrong signal to the country. They reinforced a pair of remaining riders with volunteers, and the trip continued. The group traveled from Birmingham to Montgomery without incident. But on their arrival in Montgomery, they were savagely attacked by a mob of more than 1,000 whites. The extreme violence and the indifference of local police prompted a national outcry support for the rioters, putting pressure on President John F. Kennedy to end the violence. The rioters continued to Mississippi, where they endured further brutality and jail terms, but generated more publicity and inspired dozens of more freedom rides. By the end of the summer, the Interstate Commerce Commission issued rules prohibiting segregated transportation facilities. 1963, March on Washington. The August 28, 1963 March on Washington riveted the nation's attention. Rather than the anticipated 100,000 marchers, more than twice that number appeared, astonishing even its organizers. Blacks and whites side by side called on President John F. Kennedy and the Congress to provide equal access to public facilities, quality education, and decent housing for African Americans. Vote. Before 1969, only an estimated 23% of voting age blacks were registered nationally. But by 1969, the number had jumped to 61%. In the southern states, the numbers were more dramatic. During the same period in Mississippi, for example, African American registration jumped from 6.7 to 66.5%. This increase in registration led to the election of African Americans to federal, state, and local offices. Enforcing civil rights for all Americans. Dated from just after the Civil War, a series of constitutional amendments were passed to protect African Americans. Without enforcement by the federal government, however, African Americans, especially those in the South, were gradually denied almost every right of citizenship. We shall overcome. We shall overcome seems to have first been sung by striking tobacco workers in Charleston, South Carolina in 1945. In the 1960s, the song became the all but official anthem of the civil rights movement. Before I was born, fight for the rights that we have today. Had it not been for their sacrifices, today we would not have equal opportunities in employment, housing, education, as well as the right to vote. I wouldn't be able to stand here today in this facility and deliver this message without their sacrifices. Even though we have made great strides in civil rights, education, politics, while we even have an African-American president, the struggle is not over because we still lack an economic empowerment. African-Americans before me fought for our rights, and now our generation doesn't even appreciate or realize what type of difficult and brutal treatment they endure. I hope that the entire African-American race can realize that we should go out and use our rights to the best of our ability. Once again, I am Austin Brooks, and I am a proud and dedicated member of the Somerset chapter of the New Jersey Orators. Thank you, and have a pleasant day.
Thank you very much. I was very impressed and amazed by your talent. And I want to tell you, Osamar and Austin, that you actually are going to meet some people that you spoke about in the presentation, people who were activists during the civil rights movement, who were young college students. I see two out of the three presenters here. I just want to make sure, is Jerome Harris in the room? I didn't see him slip in. Okay. So, knowing that, I'm going to invite two really outstanding individuals to please come forward and join us on the podium. And I'll do it alphabetically. So, Richard E. Barber Sr., would you stand and join us? And also, particularly, we're talking about these people, so you have to meet them, right?
Yes.
I don't know if they would step on that side to play off, perhaps. Oh, I would nail that. Okay. Very nice, thank you. And Dr. George C. McLaurin, would you please join us here? I'm just going to very briefly your bios, which are so impressive, and add to them as we talk about your personal experiences. And isn't it wonderful that you two were in college together? Is that right?
Yes.
And in fact, some of you saw your packets. I was able to research and find the picture of both of you, and at a sitting counter, I believe it was, at your college in, let's see, was that in Greensboro, North Carolina?
Greensboro, yeah.
So the one thing that you both have in common is where you went to college. Your parents took you in different directions, But we were both at North Carolina A&T State University, and we both there?
Yes.
At the same time. So isn't that amazing how their lives have gone in different directions, and they meet here in New Jersey? They're neighbors. They're actually not too far from each other.
Right.
And how fortunate we are as a college to have you in our community. I'm so impressed and happy to meet you. On behalf of Mrs. Evelyn Field, who called me today to give you regards, tell you she's sorry she couldn't be here. This was very important for her, and she would have been the woman on the panel. We want you to know that we recognize there were women actively involved in this, and there's a reading in your packet about the role that women played during the Civil Rights Movement. But Evelyn Field was one of two women who actually was the first resident in Douglas University when it was first becoming an integrated college. And she had her own story, which we will tell you in the future. But right now, today, I just want to tell you very quickly that Richard Barber is the Deputy Executive Director of the National NAACP in New York, Deputy Director of the Opportunities Industrialization Center. You participated in civil rights efforts, which you're going to share with us. You've done so much more with your life, but forgive me in the interest of time that I hope you will reveal more of that in your talk. And of course, Dr. McLaughlin, you have so many credentials. You have your own medical dentistry practice in New Brunswick. You're a clinical associate professor in the Department of Restorative Dentistry, University of Medicine and Dentistry, a fellow of the Academy of General Dentistry, and a spokesman for dentists in your profession. And mostly important, you paved the way for so many people in the year fighting for civil rights. So if you each would take 15, 20 minutes, and tell us if you were alphabetical, so you don't know where you want to start, and share with us your wonderful history. Thank you.
Thank you so much. I first of all want to thank Ms. Evelyn Fields and Pedro Magalos for the invitation. I had an opportunity to work with Mrs. Fields some years ago when we were putting together the Paul Robeson Institute here at Raritan Valley, and Paul Robeson, one of my heroes. I also want to thank Austin Brooks for taking my speech and sharing with you all about the city movement, so I'll be very brief. But I want to remind you that I am a Baptist deacon, and being brief is not sometimes very easy. I grew up in the state of North Carolina under apartheid and a rigidly segregated society. I am one of nine children, five sisters and three brothers. My father really kind of started life as a sharecropper in North Carolina. And those of you who know anything about sharecropping is about a one-half degree above slavery. And there was a special on, I guess last week, on PBS, Slavery by Any Other Name. And that was produced by Eric Holder's wife, who is a sister of Vivian Malone, who was the first black student at the University of Alabama, if I remember correctly. I met Vivian about 25 years ago at a wedding in New York. But I grew up in North Carolina, and my father was put off a farm as a sharecropper in 1934, primarily because he made money as a sharecropper and refused to buy an automobile from the friend of the plantation owner. The whole idea with sharecropping is to keep people economically dependent and tied to the land. When my father took $600, and I'm not sure what that would be worth today, value today, but took $600, went down the road about a half mile from his plantation and bought 100 acres of woodland, cleared it, sold part to my uncle, his brother next door, and that's where nine of us grew up. And my father had two goals, to own his own farm and to see all his kids through college. He personally was responsible for six of us, through college, and that was before student loans, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And my other brother and sister, my older sister, she got married after high school, and she was in love. But she found out after about 5 years, she divorced a young man that she married, and came to New York, and went to nursing school and retired from Coney Island Hospital. My baby brother, who wanted to see the world after he finished high school, joined the Air Force and spent 4 or 5 years and came back and went to college on the GI Bill. When I went to A&T, it was just a family tradition because most of my family had gone to A&T from the 1930s, almost continually, right until today, almost continually. So we considered A&T our school, although I had a sister at Bennett College, a sister at Shaw University, but A&T was our school. Now, I couldn't go to Duke Law School because my goal in life really early was to become an attorney. My cousin and I, Donald, who ended up at Hampton, and I went to A&T, but our goal was to come to Northern Law School and return to the South and become the Clarence Bowers of the South. But I couldn't go to Duke Law School, not because of intellect, but I was born the wrong hue. But my friend from Greensboro, Walter Johnson, was the first black student in 1961 to enter the law school at Duke University. When I was in high school, I indicated I went to one of those so-called separate but equal high schools from really 12 years, separate equal, very separate but in no ways equal. And I tell the story sometime, which is a true story. I didn't realize until I was in the third or fourth grade that chalk came in long pieces. Because we got the hand-me-down books, the broken pieces of chalk from the white schools, and the books that we were using for the most part were obsolete, and so we were studying obsolescence for the most part. But my sister, who taught me to read when I was about 3.5 or 4 years old, and I started the first grade in the, at 5 years old. But education was a key to many black families in the South because we were out of the shanties of the South and the backwoods to a better life. But when I got to A&T, having grown up in the South and everything rigidly segregated, Greensboro was no different, even though I came from a small country town. I grew up in Trenton, North Carolina, and I make that distinction because I tell folks I'm not from the Trenton, this northern Trenton, New Jersey. I'm Trenton, North Carolina, a little country town. But in Greensboro, my first year was kind of a transition year because I was competing now with students from Dillard High School in Goldsboro. I was competing with students from West Charlotte, from Charlotte, Raleigh, the larger cities, and I was in physics. And physics, for those of you as educators and probably students, it's no easy task. But the first year was very smooth. I had family there in Greensboro. But the second year, 1960, is when the city movement started. Now, many people think that the city movement was a spontaneous kind of thing, but there's some planning that went into it. When Ezell Bluff in Greensboro, Franklin McCain from Charlotte, David Richmond, and Joe McNeil. Well, Joe grew up in North Carolina, as did the other three freshmen, but Joe's parents had moved to New York. And so when Joe went home for Christmas, naturally everything was segregated. On the way back to Greensboro, the further he got south, the more things became segregated. Maryland, D.C., Richmond, and ended up in Greensboro and couldn't sit down at a lunch counter at the Greyhound bus station. On February 1st, 1960, those four freshmen went to Woolworth in downtown Greensboro. Now, mind you, we could go to any counter and get school supplies, clothing, but couldn't sit at the lunch counter for a lousy hamburger, 15-cent hamburger, and a cup of coffee or Coke. Well, when that started Monday, February 1st, 1960, it really caught the city of Greensboro off guard. Because here it is, the manager didn't know what to do. They were sitting there. He was afraid to call the police. So they sat there until it closed. And as Young Brooks told you, the second day, about 25 students showed up. Well, that week, by the Saturday afternoon, we probably had 2,000 students in downtown Greensboro. Students came from Bennett College, which is an all-girls school, black all-girls school, right across the tracks on A&T, and from Greensboro Women's College, predominantly white girls school in Greensboro, now University of North Carolina at Greensboro. They joined with students from the community. And for the next few weeks, when we were not in class, we were downtown Greensboro sit-in. Now, why that was important is this. Many people think, for example, that we're really fighting just for the opportunity to sit at the lunch counter. It was an economic fight because we decided to stay in Greensboro through Easter. And Easter is a big shopping season in Greensboro. Well, our whole focus was to keep folks in downtown in a very nonviolent way. Now, I can assure you that we were in danger because we couldn't look to the police for any protection, and we confronted gangs with chains, et cetera. But our focus really was to desegregate those counters and decrease the sales of stores downtown. And the Young Books told me they had a 30% loss of sales during that period of time. And one thing I found out, money really has vocal cords. When you can use your buying power to improve your life, money has vocal cords, just like the vote in the South. The vote in the South changed the situation in the South. So when George Wallace said, segregation today, forever, et cetera, he didn't know what he was talking about. He did not know. And I just happened to be stationed in Alabama when he was governor. So the sit-in was very important for two perspectives. One, 1955 was a year, if you remember, Emmett Till, the young black boy from Chicago, went to Mississippi and was killed, was murdered. Emmett was 14 at the time, I was 15 at the time. And it had a real impact on all of us. But the second thing that happened that changed the fight on a national and international basis was Mrs. Rosa Parks sitting down in Montgomery and refusing to move. Because what happened there, as you probably know, how much time I got? 2 minutes?
You're finished. You're overtime.
What happened basically was that for 381 days, the people of Birmingham marched, Montgomery marched and did not ride those buses. And you know the rest of the story. The buses became parked. And because of that, Dr. King came to power, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I make those two distinctions because that was 1955, and 5 years later from the city movement, and why that was important, in a very short period of time in more than 50 cities across the country, the city movement became a very key thing. Why Woolworths? Why Kresge? Why Walgreens? Because we knew that if we chose a single business establishment in Greensboro, it would not have national impact. And so when the second day of the sit-in movement, a letter went to the corporate headquarters in Greensboro asking the Woolworth executives to desegregate the counters, and their answer was, no, we have to follow local customs. Well, after we left for school, after we left for summer, very quietly in July, the counties was desegregated. Most of us did not go back to our little farming community because we knew that we would probably be targeted. And so that summer, I came to New Jersey. I came up south to New Jersey and worked in Atlantic City as a bellhop and maintaining cars, parking lot in New Jersey. But it had a great impact on my life because after graduation as a second lieutenant and then into military, the very first day on active duty in Aberdeen Proving Grounds as a young lieutenant, me and three white officers went outside the post to get lunch. And we found we had to go to four different restaurants before we found a restaurant to service. Now these things are very clear in my mind because I'm doing some memoirs. I started about 5 years ago and I've committed myself to finishing the next 2 years. The story has to be told. But we only got served at Redwood Inn in Aberdeen Proving Ground. Now mind you, I had just taken the oath of office to uphold the Constitution of these United States and could not get served on Route 40 in Maryland. And that whole thing happened then to military, and then in the military, I learned the language, I wanted to go to Europe, Germany specifically, because I wanted to go for two reasons. I wanted to study the Holocaust up front, which I got a chance to do, and I wanted to study the Marshall Plan, because it just so happened that General George Marshall, one of my heroes, and I had a chance to travel 16 countries in Western Europe studying the Marshall Plan. But even in Germany, June 12, 1963, when Mega Evers was killed in Mississippi. And then 28th of August, Dr. King marched on Washington. But September 15th, when those four little black girls in the church were killed, one of those little girls, Denise McNair, was the niece of my platoon sergeant, Sergeant Robert Jackson. And I can almost tell you, we almost had a riot that day in Germany. Because when Mega Evers was killed, four white officers dressed as KKK Klansmen went into the officers' club at Heidelberg, Germany. And I don't think that story made the press back here in the United States. But I'm going to ask a reporter to find those four officers and gentlemen and find out what they are doing now. The point I'm making is that these are the struggles that we had. And finally, I want to say, when George and I were students, George was an engineering student. And this is kind of funny because I went to the military. George joined the corporation, came up New Jersey, made a lot of money. Sure. But he realized there was not enough money in business, so that he went back to school and became a dentist. So when I got here 20 years later, my friends are dentists in New Jersey.
Very good. I think Richard said about everything.
And Austin said everything.
And Austin started it all. Austin took a portion of my speech, too. But before I get into the civil rights movement there, I just want to give you a little bit about my early background. I grew up in one of the smaller and poorest counties in the state of North Carolina on a farm. In this county, we had three high schools. We had a high school for blacks, a high school for the American Indians, and a high school for whites. So it wasn't just desegregated, it was tri-desegregated in the area that I grew up. And I played in a band in high school. I was the first in my family to graduate from college, so when I got to North Carolina A&T, I didn't know what I wanted to major in. I decided that I would major in something that I thought had to do with machinery and things of that nature, so I majored in mechanical engineering. Finished, got a degree in mechanical engineering, and looked around the state of North Carolina. There were no jobs for black engineers south of Washington, D.C. So I came to New Jersey, started to work at Raritan Arsenal as an engineer. The day after I started work there, they decided that they were going to close the place. So Raritan Arsenal, as you may all know, is now Middlesex County College. So I then went to work at Picatinny Arsenal, from there to Fort Monmouth, worked there for a while, and then decided to go to dental school. And went to dental school, became a dentist, and of course practiced and also teach at the University of Medicine and Dentistry now. I've been there for a little over 20 years. But to follow up on some of the things that young Brooks said, I always look at it as one thing. Now, he can make a difference. He's made a difference with us up here already, I'm sure. He probably does not realize it. But it only takes one person to make a big difference. And if you look back into history, there were many inventors, black inventors, like Elijah McCoy, who was the first one to develop a automatic oiling device for trains and automatic equipment. If you heard the term Real McCoy, that's where the term the Real McCoy comes from. It comes from Elijah McCoy because he invented this lubricating device to lubricate engines while they were still moving. Louis Latimer was another African-American who was a great draftsman who really invented the tungsten-type filament light bulb. Prior to Louis Latimer, the light bulbs were all used porcelain. So, but then after Louis Latimer, who was a draftsman at the time, invented the tungsten filament and the light bulb. Mary McLeod Bethune, great educator, started a school in Daytona Beach, Florida for Negro girls. In 1923, that school merged with the school, the Cookman School for Boys, and now it is Bethune-Cookman, and it has been around since then, and it's still going strong in Daytona Beach, Florida, as Bethune-Cookman College. Dr. Charles Drew, a physician and researcher in the Washington, D.C. area, blood banks, because of Dr. Charles Drew's developments and inventions, where he developed a way of separating blood plasma from whole blood, we now have blood banks. Without Dr. Charles Drew, we wouldn't have blood banks today. And believe it or not, Dr. Drew died because he was in an accident near a hospital that did not accept blacks. And while transporting him across town to a hospital that did accept blacks, he died. Another one was, of course, Jackie Robinson. I'm sure everyone knows about Jackie Robinson. He made a difference in Major League Baseball. Dr. Sam Proctor, who was a mentor to both Richard and myself, and many, many others. He was also a mentor to Martin Luther King, Jr., because Dr. King followed Dr. Proctor to Boston University's theological seminary. But 50 years ago, as a young man stated, oh, there were 52 years ago now, the three young freshmen that sat down at the lunch counters in Greensboro, North Carolina. I'd like to let you know where they are today. Ezell Blair graduated from A&T in 1963, went on to Howard University, got a degree in law, came back to Greensboro to work, was actually ostracized, was not given an opportunity to work because he was considered to be a troublemaker because he had sat in at the lunch counters. Another one, Franklin McCain from Washington, D.C. Franklin worked as a chemist for the Celanese Company in Charlotte, North Carolina for about 30 years, and then he retired. He's in Charlotte, the Charlotte area today. The other two guys, David Richmond. David graduated from A&T as well. Came back to Greensboro, he was from Greensboro, had gone to grade school in Greensboro, came back for a job, could not get a job there in Greensboro, was very distraught, moved out to the mountain section of North Carolina. Then he came back when his parents were very ill, he came back to stay in Greensboro to take care of them. But then he died in Greensboro in 1990 at the early age of 49. Joseph McNeil, who was the fourth individual there, Joseph was commissioned, as Richard was, in the Air Force as a second lieutenant when he graduated from A&T. He retired a few years ago as a major general from the United States Air Force. So that's where they are today. It was a difficult task, but as young individuals at North Carolina A&T, we felt that we had to do something. And those were the things that that we did. I was not one of the leaders in the group, but I was one of the individuals that was there on a daily basis. So it was quite a thing because we knew change had to come, and it did. See, I'm much briefer than Richard there, so.
We'll entertain any questions you may have at this time. Mr. Brooks.
Not... Were we in the picture is what he's saying.
Oh, no, no.
Not in the four, not with the four sit-downers at the lunch counter.
I've been asked that question many times because many people look at Joe McNeil, who was the first, and the second was, I think, Franklin McCain, and they assume one of those fellows was me. I was not in the picture the first day I was in class. Mm-hmm. But beyond that point, we had a real group of folks downtown.
Yeah, we really had it set up. It was well organized in that if you didn't have a class during that time of day, you expected to be down there sitting down at the lunch counter or just standing there, one or the other, because we were so well organized there until what would happen. We would sit at the counter. There would be a line of individuals behind the stool at the counter, so when the first person got up that was sitting on the stool, one of us would sit down immediately. So it was impossible for anyone else to sit at the lunch counter.
Yeah. You had a question?
Yeah. I just wanted to say, while you were a student at A&T, it would be different from the science class. I was one of the students there. I'm
from
West Auburn High School in Charleston.
Oh, okay.
And my wife is from Second Ward in Charlotte.
I know about that.
Yeah. Hmm. Yes.
Who was the organizing force behind you? Who was the big organization?
I'm sorry?
Who was the big organizing force that organized everybody in the city?
It was primarily a student-led organization, but we had support. For example, Dr. King would come into Greensboro to help raise bail money. I was never so honored to have gotten arrested, because getting arrested was a badge of honor. And then we had Thurgood Marshall from the National Office of NAACP, who eventually became on the Supreme Court. He came in to provide legal advice to the students. The community kind of embraced us, the ministers, et cetera, they kind of embraced us. And most of us, for example, didn't call home and say, we're going to do this, we just did it. You know, but I remember my brother telling me, my older brother who had finished A&T in 1949, he was telling me, he said, he went into a bank one day in our little small town, and in North Carolina, one of the major banks in the eastern part of the state is Branch Bank and Trust Company. And the branch manager said to my brother, if you're sending any money to Greensboro and Richard's involved in that mess, I wouldn't send him a dime. And my brother answered very appropriately. He said, well, you know, Richard's always done what's right, and I'm sure he will do what's right in Greensboro. And that's true. I was a good student. I played football, Eagle Scout, Sunday school, the whole bit. But the thing about it is, one of the reasons why I did not go back, because I knew that we would have been targeted in those small towns. And so that summer, those of us, we got out of Greensboro because it was very hot in Greensboro, not only temperature-wise, but in terms of tension, and came to Atlantic City.
But you asked who was responsible for the organizing of it. It was actually students.
Yeah.
The students were responsible for that. The four individuals that sat down there initially, they were the initial leaders, and they were the ones who organized us there. We had no problem getting areas, the auditoriums and gymnasium on campus to organize ourselves. So we had basically daily meetings.
But if you read the history of the Senate movement beyond Greensboro, you'll see, like in Fisk University, for example, you'll see the name Diane Nash, a very prominent name. So John Lewis. Now, John Lewis was the organizer of what is called SNCC, Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, that was organized at Shell University. And so by this time, you had probably 70 or 80 cities involved in the sit-in movement. Why North Carolina was important, because we had 13 what is called HBCU school, historically black college universities. And because of that, for example, it spread very rapidly. I mean, very rapidly. But we're grateful that we would not put out a school. Now, some schools further south, the governor forced the school to be closed. And I have friends at Tuskegee, my church, Foy Robinson. They locked the school down and put the kids out of school, thinking that would break the back of the civil rights movement, of the sit-in movement. But beyond the sit-in movements, there were pray-ins, there were wave-ins across the board, the freedom rides, as somebody mentioned. So it sparked a series of things that changed the South in that context. And so we're just blessed to be a part of it and still be here today talking with you. Mm-hmm.